Welcome to Sound Off 120 here on SCScoops.com. It is Hardcore Justice Sunday, August 8th, 2010. The big TNA pay-per-view tonight. Hardcore Justice, the Last Stand, featuring the old stars of Extreme Championship Wrestling, a reunion of sorts, a one-night stand in 2010 hosted by TNA. I know there's a lot of ECW fans out there that are kind of looking forward to this pay-per-view now that the day is upon us. Getting a little excited hearing some of the names that are backstage in Orlando at the Impact Zone. Names like New Jack, Mustafa, of course, people like Sandman, Raven, Tommy Dreamer, Rob Van Dam, Beulah is in the house, Joel Gertner, quintessential stud muffin, among other names, and I'm sure there will be a couple of surprises that have been promised by Tommy Dreamer on Twitter these last couple of days. So if you are, in fact, ordering Hardcore Justice, expecting to see the Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn main event, which was the planned main event. Now, mind you, there were only two matches announced for this pay-per-view in advance. Very reminiscent of the old ECW, which very often you would not know many of the matches announced in advance. But you did. We did know in advance that RVD would be facing Jerry Lynn, non-title, in a reprise of a fantastic feud they had in the late 90s, around 2000, in the old ECW. And at least that was supposed to be the main event. We found out about a day or two ago, unfortunately, that in preparations for this match, Jerry Lynn, I guess while in the gym, suffered some sort of back injury that apparently will prevent him from competing at the pay-per-view tonight. I'm not even sure he'll be there in person. Tommy Dreamer did an interview earlier where he left the door open for the possibility that Lynn might be there, but he's just not going to be able to compete. A lot of people hoping that Sabu, who is there tonight, would replace Lynn in the main event against RVD, his former tag partner in the old ECW. Sabu, of course, one of the biggest names in the promotion's past. There were some rumors the last couple of days, 24 hours or so, I should say, that perhaps Too Cold Scorpio, who will be there tonight, would replace Lynn in the main event. You know, with Scorpio, Scorpio was never a main event guy anywhere he went, really, in this country. But he probably would be able to get a much better match out of RVD than most other people would, even though he is a bit older. I saw one rumor that said Kid Cash, who I think was in ECW for a cup of coffee, would perhaps take Jerry Lynn's spot. And all due respect to Kid Cash, again, he'd probably get the best match out of RVD when it comes to these guys, Sandman and even Sabu. You can't possibly expect this to be a fantastic in-ring performance. But apparently it is confirmed. I just noticed about 20 minutes ago, Taz, of all people, posted, and Dixie Carter posted on her Twitters. She's so fond of doing that. That the fans have gotten their wish, and it will, in fact, be Sabu replacing replacing Lynn against RVD tonight at the pay-per-view, so you will have that match. And Raven reprising his old feud with Tommy Dreamer. They'll go one-on-one. Mick Foley will be the special guest referee for that match. And again, it would not shock me to see some sort of appearance, perhaps in Dreamer's corner or a run-in of some sort by Beulah, who is, of course, married to Tommy Dreamer in real life. She is there with her kids in Orlando. And no other matches have been announced. We know that, you know, Team 3D, Brother Runt, you know, these people will be a part of the show. I have not heard definitively if Just Incredible would be there. I know Lance Storm will not be. Shane Douglas will not be. Steve Corino will not be. Taz, I believe, is going to be calling the show with Mike Tenay, so that most likely is going to be your broadcast team. I don't know if Don Callis, the former Cyrus, will be there. So, in any event, most of you are going to be listening to this after the pay-per-view is already over, so I don't really want to talk about it too much. But certainly, if you are tuning into Hardcore Justice tonight, drop me some feedback. Let me know what you think. And hopefully, for their sake, it's a good show. You know, again, the original plan was to do some sort of invasion angle. And Tommy Dreamer has been given the creative freedom to put this thing together on his own. And it was his idea to shift away from that whole invader aspect of us versus them and just have essentially another version of the ECW one-night stand reunion show from 2005 again. So that's what we're getting tonight. Now, the original pay-per-view lineup for what was their Hard Justice pay-per-view tonight is going to happen. That card is going to actually be taped, and it will air as a special edition of Impact this upcoming Thursday, August 12th. They're calling it the whole effing show. Essentially, it's the lineup that was originally planned for the pay-per-view tonight. It'll be airing on Spike TV, and a whole bunch of matches announced. Of course, RVD will defend the TNA title against Abyss. and Abyss's nail-covered board called Janice will be hanging from the ceiling. Kurt Angle goes one-on-one with AJ Styles in what promises to be, I'm sure, the show stealer of that particular event. We have Madison Rayne against Angelina Love. Jeff Hardy has an open challenge. The Pope, one-on-one with Matt Morgan against Mr. Anderson in a three-way dance. The Motor City Machine Guns versus Beer Money in the finals of their Best of Five series, which I believe is going to be a two-out-of-three falls match. So going a little old school there. And there will be appearances by some of the former ECW guys that are going to be on the pay-per-view tonight. Some, not all of them, will be at the tapings this week for the whole effing show on Thursday night. That's on Spike, so check that out. It's essentially like you're getting a pay-per-view on free TV. If they cut the bullshit and they cut the talking and the craziness and the silliness and they just put the matches out there and let these guys do what they do best, I'm sure, you know what, it may turn out to be one of the best editions of Impact of the year. If they allow that to happen. The only thing I'm a little concerned about is you're essentially condensing all these matches that were going to be on pay-per-view, a three-hour pay-per-view, into a standard two-hour edition of Impact with commercials. So there may be some rushed matches on this show on Thursday, but I guess we'll have to just wait and see. Now, we have a couple of other TNA news bits here, so a little more TNA news than we're accustomed to here on this podcast, but just for the people who have asked, all the discussion about Paul Heyman potentially coming into TNA, you might have noticed it's kind of died down a bit. There's a reason for that. Talks are not off completely, but essentially they've quieted down quite a bit, and the belief is that he is in fact not going to be coming into TNA, which of course I predicted this a couple of weeks ago. I even said, look, if Paul Heyman ends up in TNA, I will sing entrance music here on this podcast that you guys pick. I could say that because I knew it wasn't going to happen. It became very clear that if he did not get exactly what he wanted, he was not coming in. He does not need TNA. He does not want to be in TNA unless he knows he can make a difference. And if he doesn't have the power to do that, he's not coming in. So it's not a dead deal, but it doesn't look good for Paul Heyman coming into TNA. Now, there was a bit of other drama in TNA. It actually didn't occur this past week. It happened a couple of weeks ago. And miraculously, in today's day and age, it was kept under wraps far longer than I thought it would be. But Samoa Joe, one of the, I can't even really say homegrown. I guess you can call him a homegrown talent in TNA, but not really. I mean, Joe really built his name and reputation up in Ring of Honor. Samoa Joe, in many ways, is the Babe Ruth of ROH. And then he came over to TNA, I want to say back in 05, 06. He was suspended indefinitely, or rather I should say suspended for a month. Originally they thought it was indefinite, but apparently he was suspended for 1 month. I'm not sure with or without pay by TNA. What happened was a couple weeks back, he had a match with Jeff Hardy, and apparently towards the end of the match, Jeremy Borash made an announcement that there were, I think, 30 seconds left in the match. And Joe specifically went to Vince Russo, he went to the people backstage before the match and said, I don't want Jeremy Borash to announce that because it will essentially give away the fact that this match is going to go to a draw. And it'll take some of the edge off the finish. And of course, they went and did it anyway. And Joe was none too pleased about this, came backstage after the match, had a huge blow-up. It was originally believed that he basically bitched out Vince Russo right in front of Dixie Carter. That may well have happened. The belief is that what he did that got him suspended was he actually went into the production truck and chewed out a lot of the production guys and the director. And in any event, Joe basically went apeshit on a couple of different people backstage, and they felt it was unprofessional conduct on his behalf. And he was suspended. He was told, go home if you want to, and come back in a month. So that was the situation with Samoa Joe. Now look, I wasn't backstage, you weren't backstage. So who's to say what happened? Maybe Joe really was being a dick. You know, it's entirely possible he was being a dick, and he went a little overboard, and maybe he even yelled at some people that didn't deserve to be yelled at, although if he yelled at Vince Russo, it's more than deserved. But, you know, again, when you do things like this, you know, here's a guy, Samoa Joe, who's very passionate about what he does. He always has been, back in ROH and even in TNA. Why he's still passionate, I have no idea. If I was in TNA as long as Joe has been and was being pushed the way that he has been pushed, and all these start and stop pushes, they build him up as a monster, then they stop, then they build him up as a monster again, they put some shitty-looking tattoo on his face, he goes around with a machete, threatening people's lives, threatening to chop off their various extremities, and kidnapping people, all this ridiculous stuff. Then he himself gets kidnapped. By who? Who knows? Perhaps we'll never find out. But the fact is, Joe deserves better. Yes, he's overweight. He is. You know what? Samoa Joe could stand to lose a couple of pounds. But being a little heavier is part of the charm of his character. You know, if it's a health issue, let's say his weight, I wish he would lose, you know, whatever excess weight he has. I don't want him to have health issues later on in life. But it's been said that that might be part of it, too. They're not happy about the fact that he put on some pounds. And you know what? I can understand that. You want your talent to stay in shape. And round, contrary to popular belief, is in fact not a shape. And so, yes, you know, should Joe lose a little bit of weight? Sure. But again, I think he should be utilized a hell of a lot better than he is. Would I like to see him in WWE? I would. Would Vince McMahon utilize him the proper way? That's the question. You know, I could see Vince McMahon taking one look at Samoa Joe and saying, this guy really thinks he's going to be on my roster? Because again, they're still big on physique. So are they pushing more smaller guys in WWE? Yes, but still, it's all about the physique. And Joe doesn't really have much of a physique, let's be honest here. And it sucks because he's a very talented guy. I mean, for all the stuff he can do in that ring at his weight, imagine how much better he would be if he lost 15 or 20 pounds. But the fact is, he deserves better. You know, when you suspend Samoa Joe for a month and put all your eggs in this ECW basket and spend the last couple of weeks promoting a pay-per-view with a bunch of guys that are over 40 and over 50, broken down, beaten down, have not been relevant in 10 years, again, I think it speaks volumes about your product. Now, is TNA going to pop a big number tonight with this pay-per-view? I think they'll pop a bigger number than they have been. I don't see how they can pop less. You know, as I said a couple weeks ago on this podcast, the last two or three TNA shows have done less than 8,000 pay-per-view buys. The fact that that has been the case is just astounding. So I would imagine that for nostalgia and novelty, if nothing else, this show can probably do, I mean, I would certainly hope it could do at least 10,000. Could it do 20? It's possible. I mean, TNA pay-per-views for a while were doing 20,000 to 30,000 buys. Obviously, that's dropped off quite a bit. So if they pop a number, make a little bit of money, congratulations, but what does it really mean? They're not going to do ECW shows every month. You've really got to start pushing these younger guys. And really, I never thought I'd say this, but take the lead from WWE. They've done a pretty damn good job. Not perfect, but they've done a pretty damn good job with Nexus in that, again, a couple months ago, I knew a couple of these guys from NXT. I knew who Wade Barrett was. I knew, obviously, who Daniel Bryan was. I knew that Darren Young is basically a blackface version of John Cena, despite what anybody says. But I probably wouldn't be able to pick out Michael Tarver or Heath Slater out of a friggin' lineup. And I certainly wouldn't be able to put a name with the face. And now, those guys are becoming stars. Everybody can look at those NXT guys and know exactly who each one is. They've done a very good job in that respect with those guys. And they're building SummerSlam around this, essentially this youth movement. You've got NXT featured in the main event against Team Cena, which does have people like John Morrison and you know, R-Truth. They may not be the youngest guys, like R-Truth, for example, may not be the youngest guy in the roster, but he's a fresh face that they're trying to push. I can understand that, and I can respect that. I wish TNA would do more of that. So they could do their ECW pay-per-view. Hopefully they do good business. I hope they do a million buys. But after this, they've got to get back to business and get Samoa Joe back and get things going here, because that's really what their future is going to be. It's going to be AJ Styles. It's going to be Jay Lethal. It's going to be Samoa Joe. You know, when you have Jay Lethal beat Ric Flair on pay-per-view, that's fantastic. But remember, it's a pay-per-view being watched by 6,000 people. When you turn around a couple of weeks later and have Ric Flair beat Jay Lethal on TV in front of 1.5 million, you ask yourself, what is really accomplished by having Jay Lethal get his win on pay-per-view? Not much. Now, Samoa Joe is not the only person a little upset with TNA, a little frustrated behind the scenes. AJ Styles, who is in fact a homegrown TNA talent. He was there from the very beginning. He's been a world champion, an ex-champion, now he's the new TV champion. One of the most talented guys, not only in TNA, but in the business right now. Kurt Angle himself. No greater authority than Kurt Angle, who I consider one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Himself has called AJ Styles the best. That's pretty high praise. Unfortunately, when one of your top guys does an interview, as AJ Styles did this past week, I believe it was, you know, it's a problem. And AJ Styles, and I have the comments in front of me, and now the website that has them is down, but essentially AJ was being brutally honest in this interview. I mean, brutally honest, to the point where I didn't even know if this was a legitimate interview at first. I thought maybe it was a gag. But apparently it's legit, and he was basically saying, he should be the face of TNA. He doesn't understand why these ECW guys, for example, are being pushed over guys like him. And you know what? You can say it's ego. Maybe it is. You have to have an ego, I think, if you're in the wrestling business and if you're a main event guy. But a lot of the points AJ made, and again, find the interview if you can. It's not up right now, but it should be back up soon. He makes very valid points. And the fact that he would be this poignant and this honest in an interview, I can appreciate that. I'm sure TNA didn't appreciate that, and I certainly hope they don't reprimand him for it. Because he speaks truth to power. You would hope that TNA doesn't punish him, and rather it serves as a wake-up call for them. But, you know, people in the wrestling business and promoters and writers can be very fickle people, unfortunately, with very thin skin. And who knows what repercussions there may be for AJ Styles. But I thought he spoke the truth, and I respect AJ tremendously, because here's a guy who's not going to go running to WWE. He's been offered a contract at least once before by WWE to developmental, and he turned it down. He turned it down because he knew he probably would be better off in TNA. WWE may not utilize him the right way, and he's a wrestler, you know? That's what he likes to do, and he probably has more of a chance to do that in TNA than in WWE. But the fact is, you know, he's been there from the beginning, and he's as frustrated as anybody. It's not just people like me who bitch for the sake of hearing ourselves bitch. The wrestlers in the company feel the exact same way, because it's true. And until Dixie Carter and people like that wake the fuck up, nothing's going to change. They're going to continue to do this shitty little 6,000 pay-per-view buys they do every month, and they can have their little nostalgia acts, and they can keep pushing Hogan, and they can keep pushing Bischoff, because we all know that's done wonders for them these last 6-7 months. But at some point, you know, something's got to change, and hopefully, and I'd like to see more guys speak out like that, quite frankly. It's because it's rare. It's a breath of fresh air. It's rare that you hear guys in an open forum like that being as honest as AJ Styles. Now, before I started recording here for episode 120, I noticed an interesting story online. Now, I first heard about this a couple of days ago, but there was no source to the news, so I didn't put much stock into it. But now, apparently, there are sources from within WWE confirming that they have signed Tyler Black, who, for the benefit of those of you who are not familiar with the Ring of Honor product, is the ROH World Champion. If this is in fact true, and it looks as though it is, and if Black hasn't signed a contract, he certainly, it sounds like, is on the verge of signing what would be a developmental deal. Obviously, this is a blow for Ring of Honor. You know, anybody's world champion signing with another promotion is going to be a big blow. Tyler Black's a really talented guy. I've seen him wrestle in person live. I have not been to an ROH live event in many, many months, unfortunately, but I have seen him on several Ring of Honor shows in person. And, you know, he had a nice little rise for himself. You know, he was essentially what I would call a mid-card guy. He was always talented, but he was, you know, he was obviously very green when I first saw him. And he was a mid-card act, and he worked his way up. He improved his game. He stepped up. He became a bona fide main eventer. He has had some of the best matches that you will see, because he is that talented, and he's a young guy, very articulate. I think if this is true, he would be a great pickup for WWE. I have no idea what shitty name they would give him in developmental. No doubt it would be far worse than Tyler Black, which I think is actually a pretty cool name, which pretty much guarantees that they're going to change it. But if this is true, this is a big coup for WWE. I believe TNA was interested as well. They might have even made him an offer. No wonder that he would see the disarray that TNA is in and would opt to sign with WWE. So congrats to Tyler. If he hasn't signed yet, it appears as though he will shortly. What Ring of Honor will do at that point, I mean, I'm sure Tyler Black will be able to finish out whatever commitments he has and obviously would have to drop the belt. You know, Ring of Honor's been through this before. They've lost a ton of guys to TNA and WWE. You know, Austin Aries, who became Austin Starr in TNA, eventually went back to Ring of Honor. He's one of the better heels in the business right now. He's a fantastic heel. They lost him, got him back. But most guys, when they lose them for good. You know, Nigel McGuinness went to TNA. He's Desmond Wolfe. Hard for me to ever picture him being back in Ring of Honor. Not because he left on bad terms, but it would be a step back. Samoa Joe, AJ Styles competed in Ring of Honor. Christopher Daniels, who has since gone back to Ring of Honor since TNA has their heads up their asses and they fired him earlier in the year. And several other guys as well. So they'll have to weather the storm. You know, they've got a lot of talented guys there. It's a blow, but, you know, they'll get over it. And one of the good things about Ring of Honor are some of the matches that they put together with talent from outside the organization. And it came to my attention this past week that at the next Ring of Honor show at the Manhattan Center in New York City, which I would love to attend, but I will not be, the American Wolves, which is the team of Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, the Kings of Wrestling. I get my teams confused in Ring of Honor because they've got some pretty fucking badass tag teams in that company, I gotta say. I actually got a piece of feedback from somebody in the mailbag this week who was asking me about tag teams and, is it dead and are there any good teams left? And I pointed out, you know, Ring of Honor and TNA have some pretty damn good tag teams. I mean, WWE essentially has two. But you've got the American Wolves and you've got the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, and you've got the Kings of Wrestling. Haas and Benjamin, I don't believe, are going to be a permanent act in Ring of Honor, but they are being brought in for the September 11th show in New York City. It will be Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, the former world's greatest tag team in WWE, being brought in to face the Kings of Wrestling in what should be a phenomenal tag team match. Tag team wrestling is very much alive and well. You just have to look a little bit harder for it, unfortunately. So I was really impressed by that announcement. That's going to be one hell of a match, and it makes me sad that I won't be able to be at the show for it. But if you are one of the lucky ones to be in the Manhattan Center that night, you're in for a treat, because that's going to be one hell of a match. Let's talk a little WWE here. About 20 minutes in, we first get to WWE, which is rare. Big main event coming up on Raw this week, this Monday night. It will be John Cena teaming up with Bret the Hitman Hart to take on Chris Jericho and Edge. In the main event. Obviously, I don't expect Bret to be doing much. It is the go-home show to SummerSlam. And as of press time, the SummerSlam card looks a little bit like this. We've got Sheamus defending the WWE Championship against Randy Orton. We've got Kane defending the World Heavyweight Championship. God, that has such a good ring to it. Against Rey Mysterio. We've got Big Show taking on the entire Straight Edge Society, CM Punk, Luke Gallows, and Joey Mercury. And of course, pay-per-view is essentially being built around this team WWE against the Nexus. Nexus, of course, consisting of Wade Barrett, Heath Slater, Darren Young, Michael Tarver, Skip Sheffield, Justin Gabriel, and David Otunga, taking on John Cena, Bret Hart, R-Truth, The Great Khali, and John Morrison. Now, the two question marks, of course, are Chris Jericho and Edge, who, if you watch Raw this past Monday night, essentially took themselves off of Team Cena. Jericho lost to John Cena in what was a pretty damn good singles match. And the match with Orton and The Miz was pretty good too, but I like the Cena match better. And my guess is Jericho and Edge are going to still be on the team. They're not going to be off the pay-per-view. So I'm just going to go ahead and slot them in there. See, you know, I fully expect Jericho and Edge to be in the match. The talk has been, who's going to turn heel? That's all I've heard always. Somebody's going to turn heel. First of all, we don't know that somebody's going to turn heel. So don't get your hopes up for the fact that somebody is definitely going to turn heel at the pay-per-view. There's no guarantee that that's going to happen. But I do expect that somebody on that team, on John Cena's team, is going to screw them over and give the Nexus a much-needed win on pay-per-view in the main event. This is essentially the Nexus's first match on pay-per-view. And I think they should go over. I think they should prolong this angle at least through Survivor Series. I think there's a lot more mileage that they can get out of this. Perhaps build to I know it won't happen, but perhaps build to some sort of a War Games match at the Survivor Series. Since you're having a Survivor Series elimination match already at SummerSlam, you can't do the same thing in November, so maybe spice it up and make it a War Games type of match. But, you know, there's been some rumors that perhaps R-Truth is going to be turned heel. Bret Hart will maybe screw his team over. I don't see the purpose in that at all. Bret Hart cannot wrestle. Now, I like the fact that Bret Hart is on this team. I know a lot of you don't. I do, because he still has a lot of name value. He's still a big name, and having Bret Hart on the same team with John Cena is kind of cool. You can hide his weaknesses in a 7-on-7 match. He does not have to do much. It's an elimination match, so if Bret is not going to survive, He doesn't have to be pinned or made to submit. He could be counted out. He could be DQ'd for using a chair, something ridiculous like that. You could protect him in a number of ways. He's not going to really do much. He may try to put a sharpshooter on somebody, but he's not taking any bumps. We know that. But turning him heel, you know, what purpose does it serve? Unless he's going to be revealed as the secret GM, and that would make even less sense considering that he was already the GM and he got fired. So I would turn John Morrison heel, quite frankly. I am a big fan of Morrison as a heel. As a face, in the ring, he's phenomenal. We know this, you know. He's got the flexibility of a gymnast because that's what he was. He used to be a gymnast. He's far more flexible and thimble than I ever will even dream of being. It's actually quite sad. But John Morrison was a much better heel, in my opinion. On the microphone as a babyface, it doesn't help him that he's given such shitty material. You know, when he cut that promo on Raw a couple weeks back, he was in the ring with Maurice and DiBiase, and he was translating Maurice's promo back and was trying to be funny. I can't blame him, because that was the material that was written for him. He doesn't exactly have enough clout to turn around and say, fuck that, I'm not using this stuff. It was just horrible. Just brutal material that he was given, but as a promo guy, as a babyface, he's just not good. As a heel, I think he was far better. So I think, you know what? Turn Morrison heel if you're going to turn somebody heel. Why not? It may help move him up to the next level. And you know what? Morrison and Cena in an in-ring feud, with Morrison cutting heel promos as opposed to babyface ones, would be a fresh main event program on the Raw brand. Would it not? I mean, am I wrong about that? You want to see Cena Edge again? Go for it. You want to see Cena Jericho? Good. Enjoy. As great of a chemistry as they have, and I enjoyed the Jericho match on Monday night, I don't want to see them reprising these same feuds on pay-per-view. John Cena needs new opponents. Now, John Cena is not the champ. I understand that. Sheamus is. But I fully expect Cena to get the belt back sooner rather than later. And Cena's always in need of some new feuds. And when the Nexus thing is over, he's going to need somebody new to feud with. And you know what? Why not a heel John Morrison? Wouldn't surprise me, by the way, to see The Undertaker make an appearance on the pay-per-view. Obviously, he will not be wrestling. For those of you who have already forgotten, it was a year ago at SummerSlam, a terrific TLC match, CM Punk defeating Jeff Hardy, and as Punk is standing over Hardy's prone body with the championship belt held high, the lights go out. There's a gong, and the lights go out. The place goes apeshit. 10 seconds later, the lights come on, and doesn't look like Undertaker's anywhere. And then all of a sudden, he rises up from underneath Punk. Somehow, when the lights were out, him and Hardy did a switcheroo. It was very well done. I remember watching that thing, and wow, that was actually a cool moment. So, a big SummerSlam return for Undertaker last year. I think we're in for the same thing this year. I think he'll make an appearance of some sorts. It does look like Kane is most likely going to be revealed as the attacker that put him in a vegetative state. Whatever. You know, I'm just happy Kane is getting one last rub because he deserves it. But I fully expect some sort of Undertaker appearance or lightning bolt or gong or video message or something to that effect at SummerSlam. And I fully expect Kane to beat Rey Mysterio, because if he loses the belt back to that little bastard, I'm going to be pretty pissed off. By the way, I caught some highlights of the UFC 117 pay-per-view last night. I was out all night. Unfortunately, I did not get to see the pay-per-view live. But I just have to say that the fight between Anderson Silva and Chael Sonnen, just a phenomenal fight. I mean, even if you're not a fight fan or a UFC fan per se, just a phenomenal fight. And Chael Sonnen has been a very entertaining guy. He's an MMA fighter in UFC, for those of you who don't know, who so very clearly grew up a professional wrestling fan and probably still is a big pro wrestling fan. His opponent in this match is pound for pound one of the greatest fighters that UFC has ever had in Anderson Silva. He's been champion in his division for about 4 years now. The problem with Silva is he doesn't speak English, or at least he claims he doesn't. There are people who suggest he does, and he just chooses not to speak English for whatever reason. He's not a very charismatic guy, which means he's not terribly marketable. And some of his fights, quite frankly, on pay-per-view have been quite boring. He kind of toys with his opponents and looks like he's playing around with them. And it can be borderline unprofessional sometimes. So Chael Sonnen essentially took it upon himself to sell the pay-per-view on his own. He has made some pretty outlandish remarks, including a recent comment that he actually now denies he made, even though there's audio of it, where he claimed that, you know, Lance Armstrong gave himself cancer. and all this other stuff. So make no mistake, he's doing it to hype a pay-per-view that apparently it's way too early to know how well the UFC show did, but they have these trending numbers, and the numbers for the show are trending pretty damn high, to the point where an Anderson Silva pay-per-view, which really has never done terribly well, if this pay-per-view does, let's say, anywhere over 400,000 buys, it would be a tremendous success. And some of these numbers suggest that it could be as high as 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, which would be amazing. And those are numbers that WWE would just kill for. And it's numbers that TNA doesn't even aspire for because they're just so far out of the range of what a TNA show has ever done, it's just not even funny. And UFC routinely pulls in numbers like this, and it's because of people like Chael Sonnen who know how to promote themselves and who know how to promote a fight, even if everything coming out of their mouth is just utter and complete bullshit. But give the guy credit. He didn't win, but he hung in there. And in fact, it looked like he was winning the fight. I mean, he was beating the crap out of Anderson Silva. It was a dogfight, and there was very little time left in the fight, 2 minutes or something like that, in I think the final round, or maybe the fourth round, I think it was. But, you know, Silva hooked in a choke and got the tap out from Chael Sonnen, and it just kind of came out of nowhere. In effect, the champion lucked out because it looked like Sonnen was going to win. It looked like he was going to back up all the BS that came out of his mouth. I mean, it would have been, if you are not a Chael Sonnen fan, it would have been bad times for you. But as it turned out, Silva did pull out the victory. But just a phenomenal way to promote a fight. And it really, I think, is a lesson that Vince McMahon and Dixie Carter and people like that should borrow from UFC and should borrow from MMA. Which is not a fad. I mean, it's proven that it's here to stay. It's a hot product. It has been for a couple of years now. And so why not? The whole nature of the wrestling industry has been based on stealing ideas from other promotions and stealing ideas from other people. So you know what? If you're going to steal an idea, why not steal a good one? That's how you promote a match. That's how you promote a fight. I mean, we know that pro wrestling matches are fake. They're fixed. We know that. But that doesn't mean that without the right amount of promotion and the right type of promotion that you can't pop a huge buy rate. You can't get people to, you know what, turn around and say, shit, I want to see these two wrestlers go at it. So anyway, I just had to put that out there. If you did see the show last night, it was a hell of a show. And coming off the Brock Lesnar pay-per-view that they had, that was also an incredible show. So UFC has really lucked out because, again, like with any real sport, like with boxing or something like that, especially if you're building a pay-per-view essentially around one fight, if that fight ends in 30 seconds or if there's a bullshit finish, you know, a thumb to the eye that causes a disqualification or something, and you just spend $50 on that pay-per-view, you're going to be pretty pissed off. It's hit or miss. You never know really what you're going to get, but the last two UFC shows have just been tremendous events, and, you know, I just wish pro wrestling would take notice of that. Now, this past week, I believe it was Monday, actually, August 3rd. I posted about this on my Twitter page. It was the 13th anniversary of the 1997 SummerSlam pay-per-view from East Rutherford, New Jersey. And it was also the anniversary of the SummerSlam where Owen Hart dropped Stone Cold Steve Austin on his neck in the middle of a tombstone pile driver gone awry. And really, in many ways, changed the course of wrestling history. I mean, Austin did go on to become a big star, but Austin would still be, and he said this before, Austin, were it not for that neck injury, would still be wrestling right now. And so, I mean, and certainly he would have wrestled, you know, at least a couple of years beyond 2003, which is when he had his last match at WrestleMania 19 against The Rock. So, you know, who knows the sorts of feuds that we would have had with Austin still healthy and on the roster. I mean, his knees have been in pretty bad shape for a while, but it was that neck injury that essentially forced him out of the ring. And I just thought it would be kind of cool to just take a quick look back here at the 97 SummerSlam. I have not gone back and watched it recently, although I did see the pay-per-view again within the last 2 years. And it's still fresh in my mind, but I just thought it would be kind of cool just to take a moment here to go back and just rattle off the results and just kind of compare where some of these people were then to where they are now. I mean, the first match at SummerSlam, of course, was the steel cage match between Mankind and Hunter Hearst Helmsley, as he was known at the time, who had China in his corner. It was a really good cage match. Went almost 20 minutes. There was this brutal spot, and I think Mick Foley talked about it, I think, in his first book, when China slammed the cage. Now, this was back when they were still using the traditional blue bar style steel cage. And China rammed the door into his head. Now, Foley was wearing the Mankind mask back then, so it was a little bit of cushion, but not much. And he said it was some of the worst. Now, think about all the bumps and all the thumbtacks and all the barbed wire and all the bullshit that Foley has put himself through going back to his days as Cactus Jack in WCW. And he claimed in his book that this was some of the worst pain he's ever experienced in his life, thanks to China. But he did go on to win the match. He did the Superfly dive off the top of the cage, and I think he kind of morphed into Dude Love at the end. And it was a really good cage match, actually. And Helmsley would go on to have even better matches with Foley in 2000. I still maintain that street fight between the two of them at the 2000 Royal Rumble at MSG is the match that made Triple H. It made him as a main eventer. It convinced people that this guy is the real deal. It legitimized him, and he could thank Foley for that. I don't think he ever has. In fact, I don't know that Triple H really thinks very much of Mick Foley based on some comments I've heard him make in the past, and I can't quite understand why. I'm not sure if it's because, you know, for years Triple H, of course, hung around Ric Flair, and they were good friends, and Flair never really had a very high opinion of Foley, called him a glorified stuntman. I know the two of them are on better terms now, but why Triple H has always been, what's the word I'm looking for? Not so much down on Foley, but never really paid him, I think, the respect he deserved for helping make him. I don't quite understand that. Goldust defeats Brian Pillman. This was during the angle where Pillman would go on to, he essentially had Goldust's wife Terry as his slave. The angle never really did reach a conclusion, unfortunately, because Pillman died. They found him in a hotel room that was in October of 97 before the pay-per-view Bad Blood, where he was actually supposed to be having a match, I believe. Actually, no. I don't know if it was. I don't believe it was a match with Goldust. There was some sort of wedding or angle or something that was going to be taking place. But in any event, on this pay-per-view, Goldust defeated Pillman. Pillman, as per the stipulations of the match, had to wear a dress, which I think he, as I recall, he did the very next night on Raw. Legion of Doom, Hawk and Animal, defeating the Godwins in a tag team match. Nothing particularly special here. Of course, Hawk passed away in 2003. He is no longer with us. And Legion of Doom should easily be in the Hall of Fame. British Bulldog defeated Ken Shamrock as a result of a disqualification. Another match where we have a dead wrestler. It's hard to fathom this. I mean, 1997, yeah, it was 13 years ago, but it really doesn't seem like that long ago. And yet, you know, you look up and down this list, and even on this show, there's a handful of guys who are gone. And it's actually, you know, it's actually quite depressing. In this match, this was for the European Championship. If Bulldog had lost the belt, he would have had to have eaten a can of dog food. That was the stipulation in this match. And as I recall, I think he threw the dog food in Shamrock's face on the outside. And Shamrock at the time, you know, Shamrock was a former UFC champion. He came over. He was a fighter. And he would snap. He just had a short fuse, and he would snap at the drop of a dime. And when he had that dog food thrown in his face, he just lost it. And he beat the shit out of a whole bunch of referees and basically got himself disqualified. We had Los Boricuas, the team of Savio Vega, Miguel Perez, and Jose Estrada, and Jesus Castillo defeating the Disciples of Apocalypse, Crush, Chains, 8-Ball, and Skull. One of the most boring factions in WWE history, easily. Easily. I mean, this was back during a period where you had The Nation, the Boricuas, the Truth Commission, and you know, eventually DX would pop up and all that. It was gang warfare. You had the Hart Foundation, DOA, and Los Boricuas put me to sleep more times in 1997 than any infomercial that I could possibly watch at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was just phenomenally boring. I never got any pleasure out of watching any of these matches that involved these guys. I don't know why, but Ambien and Lunesta have nothing on these guys. Intercontinental Championship match, as I mentioned, Steve Austin did defeat Owen Hart. Not sure how he managed to do it, but he did crawl over after he got dropped on his head and kind of cradled Owen over. It looked very weak. It was a very weak-looking finish, but that was the planned finish, and they stuck to it. Austin won the IC title, not after being dropped on his head, suffered a stinger, and it just led to a myriad of issues for him. He would have to have spinal fusion surgery in late 99. Actually, it might have been January of 2000 when he actually had the operation, and it put him out of action for a good 9 months. again. I don't really think... I really honestly don't believe Austin was ever the same after that. I know he came back. He had some great matches with Kurt Angle and The Rock and guys like that in 2001. But to me, as an in-ring performer, he was never the same. And as a draw, he was never the same. I know WrestleMania 17 did big business and all that. It was probably one of the greatest manias of all time. But being gone for a long period of time like that, I think, and The Rock became a bigger star in his absence, and Triple H became a bigger star in his absence, really took some of the edge off Austin. It just never quite felt the same to me again after that. Owen Hart, of course, would go on to be, well, most remembered for an unfortunate accident that happened at the Over the Edge pay-per-view in 99 when he fell 80 feet to his death during the pay-per-view. Austin and Owen were not good friends after that. Austin, in fact, didn't like Owen Hart very much at all, because Owen Hart never really apologized. He never checked in on Steve after what happened, even to the point where Bret Hart actually took Austin's side and felt that Owen did the wrong thing. Owen fucked up on the move. If you go back and watch it, that's not the way that you should be executing that maneuver. He should have landed on his knees and not his ass, but shit happens. But I know that Austin and Owen were not exactly drinking buddies after that pay-per-view. And for those that have asked about this before, why was, Steve Austin was, I think, the only guy, the only WWE performer who did not appear at Owen Hart's funeral in 99. And that led to people speculating that, well, how petty can he be just because he's pissed that Owen dropped him on his head. In reality, Austin does not go to funerals. He does not like funerals. He does not go to them. And there's that famous story of Eddie Guerrero's funeral back in 05. And Austin wasn't even an active member of the roster at the time. But people, as they were exiting the church, as I recall hearing, said that they saw Austin sitting about 200 or 300 feet away from the church, just sitting by himself on a hill, which is a little weird. But I guess that's just his way of grieving. So that just puts that shit to bed that, Austin didn't go to Owen's funeral because he was pissed at him. No, he just doesn't go to funerals. If you may recall that tribute edition of Raw the night after Owen died, it was Steve Austin who ended the show by doing a toast on the air in the middle of the ring to Owen's memory. So, Bret Hart defeats The Undertaker in the main event, WWE Championship on the line. Shawn Michaels, the special guest referee, with the tightest of shorts. Actually, no, I'm sorry, that was a different pay-per-view. I remember Sean wore those ridiculously tight biker shorts when he reffed the Iron Man match. That was between Triple H and The Rock in 2000. He was the guest referee. He did wear long pants in this match, thank God. And he pretty much called it right down the middle. The big storyline going into this was, of course, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels were not fond of each other. Big surprise. And Bret felt that WWE and Vince McMahon specifically, and this is when they were really busting down the doors of kayfabe at the time, and really acknowledging that Vince McMahon, who all these years had been the owner of the company in reality, but was never really acknowledged as being more than an announcer on TV, and all of a sudden people were calling him the boss, and this was kind of ushering in the era of attitude. Shawn Michaels was appointed the guest referee, but with some caveats, and that caveat was that if Shawn in any way cost, I believe it was either man, but more so Bret Hart, the match, and basically didn't call it right down the middle, he would be barred from competing in the United States, which essentially means he would be banned from wrestling in a WWE ring, since the majority of their shows are, in fact, on U.S. soil. And Shawn did a fine job being a referee. The match got a little slow. It wasn't a bad match. It actually got pretty good towards the end. And the big spot was Bret Hart had used a steel chair on The Undertaker behind Shawn Michaels' back. And Shawn saw the chair laying in the ring, picked it up, spun Bret Hart around as he was stomping on The Undertaker in the corner, and basically asked him, "What the hell is this?" And Bret denied it. He denied that he used it. He didn't know why it was there. He went back to kicking The Undertaker. Shawn spun him around a second time, and now Bret Hart was pissed. And Michael said, "Look, can't do this. I'm gonna disqualify you if I see you using it again." And Bret proceeded to hawk the biggest loogie you've ever seen and just spat right in Shawn's face. And Shawn, with the chair in his hand, hauled off and went to hit Bret. Bret ducked, and he hit The Undertaker instead. Knocked him out. And it was actually a pretty wicked chair shot to the skull. And Bret went for the cover, and Shawn realized that he's got no choice but to make the count or else he's barred. He's not going to be able to wrestle in the U.S. anymore. So he made the three count, and just like that, Bret Hart was the new WWE champion, his final title reign in WWE, his fifth one. And it was the night after this on Raw that Shawn Michaels became a heel. He cut a heel promo, started his great feud with The Undertaker that led to two phenomenal matches. The Ground Zero match at the September pay-per-view, which was actually their very first one-on-one match. And the infamous Hell in a Cell, the very first Hell in a Cell match of Bad Blood, that was where Kane made his debut. I'm not really a big fan of the casket match they had at the Royal Rumble. Shawn got hurt in that match, but moreover, I just didn't think it was a very good match. But those two matches in 97 were freaking phenomenal. Bret Hart, of course, even though he won the championship, you would never know that he was a world champion because Shawn and Undertaker essentially got top billing in the company after that. They main evented the next two pay-per-views, and Bret Hart was relegated to having matches with the Patriot. And then I think at the October pay-per-view, he teamed with Davey Boy against the Patriot and Vader in a flag match. Not exactly becoming of a world champion. No wonder Bret was pissed off. So that's your SummerSlam rundown right there from 1997. I just figured it would be nice to kind of take a look back and see where people are today relative to where they were then. And you know, of course, Shawn Michaels is now retired, and him and Bret Hart have made amends. Shawn even tweeted recently that him and Bret, since Shawn retired and essentially left the company, he still communicates with Bret via text message every now and then, which is actually really cool to know. I mean, it took 12 years, but the fact that they've been able to put that shit to bed and they're actually, that may not be best of friends, but they are friends, is something I didn't know that we would ever see. And Undertaker, of course, I can't really say Undertaker is still going strong because clearly he's beaten up and he's winding down, but he still goes out there and competes at a high level. He's a main eventer and he's had some phenomenal matches in recent years. I don't know how he's done it with those knees and those hips, but God bless the guy. He's still going. You will not find too many big men that are 6'10", 300 pounds like he is, who can compete at that level as long as he has. It's almost unheard of. And in fact, as The Undertaker's career went on, he seemed to have better matches the older he got. I mean, he's probably had more 4-star matches and 5-star matches in the last 10 years of his career than he did in the first 10 when he was younger and moved around a lot better. But his matches with guys like Shawn Michaels, Kurt Angle, The Rock, Steve Austin, Jeff Hardy, and even a lot of other guys on the SmackDown roster, Brock Lesnar, have really just been nothing short of fantastic. And it's a pretty impressive feat, I must say. All right, so let's break into the mailbag here, the traditional mailbag, back to your email questions. And, of course, you can always email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. We have a short and sweet question here from David Coates. Dear Solomonster, is there anyone that TNA wouldn't hire? Well, they wouldn't hire me, so there's your answer. Here's a question regarding an undisputed championship. James, listening to the podcast in Sound Off 109, friend on Facebook, follower on Twitter, and subscriber on iTunes. Wow, the trifecta. Let's see here. Alrighty. His question is, do I feel the WWE will have an undisputed heavyweight champion in the next several years once again? By that I mean, when WWE bought WCW, they were the only major wrestling promotion that was televised in America, and then they unified the WCW and WWE championships to make the undisputed title. Considering how poorly TNA is doing funds-wise with pay-per-views and basically everything, and ROH not being extremely well-known, do you foresee WWE being the only major wrestling promotion being televised soon, giving them the ability to create an undisputed championship once again? Well, I don't see how the two go together. I don't quite understand the question. Are you implying that if TNA goes belly up and ROH goes belly up, that WWE is going to just buy them out? I don't see where one has to do with the other. I think if TNA ever goes out of business, you know, WWE would probably be interested in swooping up the trademarks and the video library, but Ring of Honor, I don't think they would necessarily. I don't think one has to do with the other. I think if WWE wants to merge the brands, they will. Now, is it going to happen? I don't think it will, because I think it would have happened already. Would I like to see a unified world champion? Absolutely. Having one world title is far better than having two or three. But if they haven't done it already and they are committed to keeping the Raw and SmackDown brand separate, it's not going to happen. We're going to have two world champions. There's just no way around that. So You know, now, do I foresee WWE being the only major promotion on TV? No, I don't foresee that at all. I think TNA is in trouble right now, but they're not going to go out of business in the next 6 months. If it happened, it wouldn't be for maybe another year. And in all honesty, I think they'll you know, look, as long as they have funding from the Carters and Panda Energy, they'll be okay. If the Carters are okay losing money, then by all means. But make no mistake, TNA is in trouble. Now, Ring of Honor has always been on shaky ground. You know, they have good times, they have bad times. They make a lot of their money off DVD sales, and quite frankly, DVD sales have been pretty soft. But they've managed to survive for several years. In fact, Ring of Honor is older as a promotion than TNA is, I believe. Maybe even only by a couple of months, but I think, as I recall, it was back in 2002 that they were open for business. So I think there'll always be at least a secondary wrestling promotion that's out there. WWE is always going to be the big game in town. There's nothing that's going to change that, no matter how hard anybody tries. It's hard to compete with millions and millions and millions of dollars, brand name recognition that WWE has, and a rich history. You know, they're not a promotion that's starting from scratch with no history and no video library. I mean, WWE has over 50 years of history from which to draw from, and multiple fan bases that they can cater to. The old school wrestling fans, the hardcore wrestling fans, the Attitude Era fans, the modern day fans. No other promotion in existence has that. And, you know, maybe it's just my eternal optimism, which is kind of funny considering I don't really fancy myself an optimist, but I think there'll always be a secondary wrestling promotion. I hope there is. You know, it's no fun to just have one company, and TNA is so far behind, but still, they are by default number two. Ring of Honor would probably be number three. I'd rather have that number two and number three than not have them at all. And the wrestlers would too, because it just gives them more jobs. Jason in San Diego writes in, "Dear Solid Monster, been listening since episode 90. After watching the video of Macho Man at Comic-Con, why did wrestlers move from side to side while doing promos back in the day? I think that's what's missing from today's mic skills." Well, it's not the moving back and forth so much as it is those old school promos from backstage where the camera was focused on the wrestler. Every now and then, they'd switch to a secondary side camera. At least in WWE, they did this. And the guy would shift his eyes over to that camera, and then they would revert back to the hard camera. You know, promos where guys actually looked directly into the camera and spoke to us. They didn't... You know, one of the things that just annoys the fuck out of me when I watch interviews on Raw, and even the pay-per-views, is you'll have Randy Orton, for example. Now, I know he hears voices in his head, but nonetheless, Randy Orton is standing there doing an interview with, the fuck is his name? Josh Matthews. And Josh Matthews, I mean, God bless him, he asks the most ridiculous questions in the world. I mean, just ridiculous. He's no Mean Gene Okerlund, let's put it that way. But he'll ask a question, he'll put the mic up to Randy Orton's mouth, and Orton is looking off screen. I have no idea what the fuck he's looking at. I can only guess, perhaps. There's a bird flying around, maybe, and he's just trying to catch it. You know, perhaps there's a stripper popping out of a birthday cake. I don't know. But he's always focused on something off camera that you and I can't see. And when he talks, he's either looking off into the distance or he's staring at Josh. You don't stare at Josh. Stare at me. I'm the one you're talking to. That it's just such a simple, stupid thing. I mean, maybe I'm making a bigger deal out of it than I need to be, but just think about it. If this is the sort of thing you never really pay any attention to, the next time you watch a promo on WWE TV, watch it. Pay attention to it. In TNA, they do actually, I think they do a better job, but it's just such an old-school thing, and it's such an easy thing. You don't have to have Mean Gene. You can have Josh Matthews, but have a hard camera that doesn't rock back and forth like the fucking Blair Witch Project. You know, a stable camera, and the wrestler will look into the camera. It's such a simple thing. And, you know, it won't change the fact that promos just, you know, in 2010, promos are just fucking terrible because the material is terrible, but it would help. I really think it would go a long way towards making them work better. We got a letter from one of my great listeners with perhaps one of the greatest names I've ever heard. Calls himself the Shining Wizard, but his real name apparently is Brock Benningfield. No relation, I'm sure, to Lesnar or Carwin. Carwin. Lesnar. Brock Lesnar. The fuck am I thinking? There's another Brock that I know. it's actually another wrestler, and I can't remember his last name. I thought it was Carwin, but in any event, Brock Benningfield writes in, and he's been listening to the Sound Off since episode 50, and wants everybody to know that he is not a John Cena fan. However, wants to know what I have against jean shorts, I guess based on a comment I made last week. And second of all, he wants to know if he's the only person who thinks Husky Harris sucks. Well, first questions first. I actually own a pair of jean shorts myself. Just one. So I'm not against them, per se. It's the idea that John Cena always wears them that kind of irks me. They're really not cool in 2010. You know, Bret Hart wearing them at WrestleMania just made me very sad. Because everybody was hoping he'd be coming out in the pink and black. And looking at him wearing a pair of jorts to WrestleMania was quite the stunner. But the thought of Bret Hart and John Cena potentially both wearing jean shorts at SummerSlam is even more terrifying to me, so I really hope it doesn't happen. And on your question about Husky Harris, yes, in fact, you are the only one, I think, who thinks he sucks. Got a couple of questions here, including one from Ash from Melbourne, Australia, wanting to know about this supposed new WWE logo that's been floating around. If you do like a Google search for it, and I think you probably will even be able to find the post. I'm pretty sure it was posted up on SE Scoops. I didn't post the item on it because I'm no longer the interim acting webmaster, but I saw the supposed logo, and I don't like it. Essentially what they did, it's kind of a play off the old WWF logo, only they stuck an E at the end, which I can appreciate because, you know, the current scratch letter logo without the F makes abso-fucking-lutely no sense. Essentially, it's WW. it just doesn't work. So I'm all for a new logo, but the new logo supposedly that was floating around the internet, which may, you know what, it may well have been legit, but it may have been an early incarnation, or it may be the new one. I don't know. From what I understand, if there's going to be a new logo unveiled, it will be August 30th. August 30th is going to be the 900th episode of Monday Night Raw. There are rumors that they are going to unveil a new logo that night. I don't know if that's accurate. Because, again, when you create a new logo and you brand yourself with a brand new logo, it costs a lot of money to update all of the materials, all of the written and print materials, all of your online media. This is a global company. Everybody knows that scratch letter logo. It's been around for years and years and years. And I remember when they lost the court case in England and had to change their name, thanks to those panda-loving motherfuckers over in the UK. Sorry. Sore spot for me. I remember that the rumor was that to change the name and to change the logo potentially could cost the company up to $50 million. Which may have been a little high of an estimate, but it costs money. So to just voluntarily change your logo, it's not an easy decision to make. I'm a little skeptical of it, but if it's going to happen, it's going to happen on August 30th. So watch for it then. Luis writes in, "Dear Solo Monster, since Vince McMahon wanted to be considered the Walt Disney of pro wrestling, which era do you think he personally enjoys the most? My bet would be the early 90s. Vince enjoyed the era where he made the most money. So the late 90s and early 2000s are pretty much a safe bet. That was the biggest boom period the company has ever had. They went public during that particular time period. They did phenomenal television ratings. They did phenomenal pay-per-view buy rates for that era anyway. Of course, UFC has since trumped that. But and I just think the product overall, it was edgier, but it was also just a much better, much more entertaining, much more fun product. Plus, you know, Vince always wanted to be a wrestler when he was younger. And as the story goes, his father did not allow him to be. He did not want young Vincent Kennedy to become a pro wrestler, and so Vince became an announcer. Once he finally had the opportunity to begin competing a bit and participating in all of those angles and the Austin versus McMahon stuff and the corporation, and he started wrestling in some matches, I mean, I'm sure he enjoyed the hell out of doing that. So my guess would be late 90s, early 2000s would probably be Vince McMahon's favorite time period in his company's history. And let's see here. We got a listener in Saudi Arabia writing in, listening since episode 91. "Dear Solo Monster, do you think the TNA's failed Monday Night experiment actually took some of their viewers away from their product? I think WWE has noticed TNA's failure and are capitalizing by trying to put on better shows. WWE does not care enough about TNA to put on better shows because of them. Let's put that fallacy to bed. They want to put on better shows because they want their own numbers to increase. And they have, to some degree, with this Nexus angle. As far as TNA goes, they did lose a lot of viewers as a result of the Monday Night Experiment. Their ratings the last couple of weeks with the push for the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view have been up. They've done a 1.2 the last 2 weeks. So it looks like they've been able to gain most, if not all, of those viewers back. That's the good news. The bad news is the number was already lower, you know, than it should have been for a company that's been in business for 8 years, that spent millions of dollars to sign Hogan, Bischoff, Foley, Jarrett, Singh, Hardy, Anderson, RVD, among others, Angle. They should be doing better than a 1.2. They should be doing better than a 1.3, which I think is their all-time record. It's sad. So yes, they've gained a lot of those viewers back. Let's see after Hardcore Justice if they can keep those numbers up. I'm skeptical whether or not they can do that. And last but not least, let's go with our buddy Stuart, writing in, Dear Solo Monster. Wanted to ask you about the Vince McMahon limo explosion angle from 2007. What were your thoughts on the storyline, and do you know where they were going with it before its ultimate cancellation? Finally, wanted to say that I was thinking about great potential matches, and one that came to mind was Shawn Michaels against The Rock. I think they are two of the best in the ring and on the mic, and would lead to a terrific match. Did this match ever take place, and what would be your dream match with any wrestler past or present? I thought the limo explosion storyline was really stupid, quite frankly. It's just too bad that it took a man killing himself and his family to force its abortion. Pretty sure they were toying with the idea of either Linda McMahon being behind it or Vince faking his own death, which sounds more likely. As far as your second question is concerned, HBK and The Rock never had a match. Their paths just barely missed each other. The only real interaction they had at one point, both of them were both part of the Corporation faction. But that was pretty much the extent to which Rock and Michaels ever really performed together. Rock likely would have balked at the idea anyway to have a match. He was not very fond of Shawn Michaels. I think that's lessened in recent years. I think he has great respect for Shawn. Again, it had to do with when Shawn was much younger, him and Marty Jannetty had competed for Rock's mother or grandmother, who promoted wrestling in Hawaii. And Shawn was basically being a dick. Big surprise, I know. Rock never forgot this. He also was pretty good friends and still is with Bret Hart. And obviously took Bret Hart's side when it came to the Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels stuff, so that didn't help. As far as dream matches, you know, and obviously there aren't too many left, unfortunately, in wrestling, but you know, Rock and Michaels would be a phenomenal match. I just think that their chemistry would be great, and I think they would put on a fantastic match. Hogan versus Austin is still the ultimate dream match. Now, it was obvious to me years ago, but people were still holding out hope, and obviously now there's no way in hell this match will ever happen. Hogan is. According to Eric Bischoff, Hogan's done wrestling. I mean, his back is that bad, he just cannot do it. And, you know, the planned match with him and Abyss may well not happen. I don't know that it's been completely abandoned, but the belief is that Hogan's done. I mean, he can barely move when he walks. It's actually quite sad to watch. But in their primes, as draws, Hogan versus Austin is the biggest match you could possibly put together. It won't necessarily be a phenomenal in-ring bout, but as Rock and Hogan proved at WrestleMania 18... you can still put on one of the most memorable matches of all time, just based on the aura around it. If you have two of the biggest names in the history of the business, face-to-face, nose-to-nose, in front of 60,000 people, with flashbulbs going off like crazy, it's a phenomenal feeling. I think from a pure box office perspective and because of the aura it would bring, Hogan-Austin is the match. There is no other match that comes close, as far as I'm concerned. I can come up with a couple of matches, you know, not like top dream matches, but, you know, for example, there was a period back in 93, late 93, early 94, where Bret Hart and Owen Hart were wrestling tag team matches together before Owen ultimately turned on his brother again. There was one match that was actually taped for a Coliseum video. I don't believe it ever aired on TV. It was the Hart brothers, Bret and Owen, against the Steiner brothers. And the match is a long match. I think it went like half an hour. I watched that match, and I have it somewhere on DVD, and it's a phenomenal match. You could probably find clips of it on YouTube. It's a great, great match. Bret and Owen worked really well, surprise, surprise, as a tag team. And I always thought that, you know, with both teams in their prime, and everybody alive and well, obviously, Bret and Owen Hart in a tag team championship match against Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit. What a fucking phenomenal tag team match that would be. I mean, just wow. So, you know, you come up with little dream matches like that. But again, a match like that, while in the ring, it would be light years ahead of what Austin Hogan could do. Hogan-Austin is still the all-time dream match that will never happen. So that's going to do it for the mailbag here. We'll cinch this bad boy back up again. TheSolemonster@gmail.com is the email address if you want to get your questions on the air. That's still the best way to try to do it. I'm sure we'll do a Facebook or Twitter mailbag again at some point. Twitter.com/Solemonster. You can hit me up on there. And, of course, Facebook.com/TheSolemonster. Friend me on Facebook if you have not already done so. I want to take this opportunity here to just thank everybody who has just continued to send in their thoughts and well wishes on the passing of my aunt, which, you know, again, hit all of us very hard, and it's been a rough couple of weeks, but, you know, slowly but surely you kind of put that behind you and move on. And one of the things that that I've done, and I posted about this on my Facebook page, is it's not a fun per se, but some people, family members, and even some podcast listeners had asked, you know, what can we do to help, and is there any sort of charity that would be appropriate to make a donation to, which is just awesome that people would ask that. And again, my aunt had diabetes. It's pretty likely that it played a role, even indirectly, in her death. And I just think it would be appropriate to put any sort of gift or dollars or anything like that towards research into treatments and cures and whatnot for type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which, you know, 24 million people in this country and counting suffer from it. And it's a pretty insidious disease. If you really read up on it, and I'm sure there's people listening who don't need me to kind of school them on diabetes, pretty nasty stuff. And so one thing that you can do, and I posted about this on Facebook, and this will be the only time I mention it here on the podcast, and Webmaster Mike, by the way, was a really classy move on his part to let me post it, this information on the main page as to where people can send checks for donations, however big or small. You can get that information. There is a personal note that I posted on my Facebook page. if you just scroll down through all the various postings that have cluttered up my wall, you'll see a note, or just click the notes tab, and there's a note from me with all the information on who to make the check out to. It's Columbia University Medical Center in New York, and who the check should be mailed to. Her name is Sally Benner. She is the person that's going to be the point person handling this for me. You can also make donations easier if you choose to do so online through their website. All that information, it's in the note on my Facebook page. Please check that out if you haven't already done so. And I mean, look, anything that you want to contribute, like I said, however big or small, it's being done in her memory. So if you're, you know, if there's a check being written, you would write on the note line, IMO. My aunt's name was Cecilia Katz, CECELIAKATZ. You do the same thing online. Just mention that it's in her memory so we know exactly, you know, why the money is being sent. And just spread the word, you know. It's for a good cause. I really appreciate all the kind words that I'm still getting from people. And just wanted to take a moment here on the podcast to just mention that to everybody. You could also find that post, by the way, on SC Scoops. If you scroll down, there was a post I made during the week with the same information in there. One other quick note here. I may have a nice little surprise for you guys here on the podcast within the next week or two. I don't really want to say more than that right now because it's not a done deal. But just figured I would mention that. Should be a cool little something I might be able to have for you here on the show in the next few weeks. So you might want to, well, you guys tune in every week. You guys are awesome. But tune in especially these next couple of weeks. So on that note, that's going to do it for episode 120 of The Sound Off. Again, most of you, by the time you're listening to this, I'm sure the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view will be in the books. Send in your feedback, and if you are tuning in, and good, bad, or indifferent, let me know what you think. Of course, Raw tomorrow night, the go-home show to SummerSlam coming up next Sunday. And it's going to do it. Till next time, episode 121, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to The Sama Monster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing. Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here. Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business. On SE Scoop.